I'm Stargate Pioneer from the Starling Tribune, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
We are Gallifrey Public Radio. We are a weekly Doctor Who podcast, and thank you so much for joining us here. We're expecting some overspill because Josh told us that he was going to get people loaded over at the match game and send them this way, but we'll see whether or not that pans out.
He might be a lying bastard.
Josh himself might be loaded as well. But that's fair. We are going to do a live recording tonight. We're going to do this as a supplemental to our normal weekly installments. My name is Keir. Joining me, as always, is...
I'm Jay Witten.
And over to his right is...
Haley Malley.
And together we are Wild Stallions! But that's a different show. We decided tonight that we had a particular topic that's been coming up a lot today.
Right, yeah.
In various panels.
Well, let's just get this out of the way real quick. We're typically a very clean podcast.
Not tonight.
But given the nature of what's going on tonight...
Yeah.
Welcome to GPR, After Dark.
After Dark. The whole thing is After Dark. Yeah, we normally save this stuff. We save this stuff for usually the post-credits for people that are actually listening after the theme music plays out. And Jay had the bright idea to say, oh, you know what, let's just keep the recorder going for like an extra 5 minutes and stuff while we're doing our wrap-up. Because our banter when we're done and we're tired and Jay's got about 2 hours of sleep and 48 hours and things, it gets interesting. So we figured we'd keep it. And then there was like a week or two where we didn't do it and people got nasty. Where's the GPR After Dark? Make more with the funny.
Dance, monkey.
Saddest.
Saddest strip dance ever.
So yeah, this tonight we're going to talk about the show as a whole and the permanency of the change. I mean, this is a show that is, you know, it's constantly changing and constantly evolving, and that's, it's built into the show, and yet the moment that you change something away from something that someone likes, they're up in arms.
Right.
So, you know, it can be the actors, it can be the stories, it can be pretty much anything. Someone's always going to get offended, even though that's, you know, this is what the show is about.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we wanted to try to make sure that we addressed was that the change, while disruptive and while controversial within the circles that it tends to offend, is possibly and arguably necessary for the ongoing nature of the program. The program is built and structured and written to be a subject of change. So that's one of the things that we wanted to try to address tonight, because yes, people are going to get up in arms about whether it be a casting change, a format change, a tonal change, and things of that sort. It may be a necessary thing. You have to take experiments. You have to take chances in order to take a 52-year-old program and keep it fresh for an audience that's constantly evolving under your feet. And it is, as we just I interjected in the end of the last group that was in here, they were discussing saying goodbye to companions. And I had to say, you know, folks, you got to remember, this is a business. At the end of the day, whether it be you're looking at it within the BBC or if you're looking at the heat that's on the back of Brian Minchin and Stephen Moffat's necks, it's a business and it has to remain viable. So as Jay refills his drink...
Hey, we've been advertising for weeks that this is going to be a drunk cast. I'm just making sure it's not false advertising.
Way ahead of you, baby. So, I blame that on the engineering major.
I can make it.
That was Haley's corner.
Yeah, yeah. Haley's we gave it to the engineer to control the duct tape. We figured if anyone... So, okay. So step one really has to do with what tends to be the biggest touch point with audience members, and that's casting changes. Whether it be your titular role, I said titular.
Titulate the bronze.
whether it be the doctor, his or her self, or whether it be a companion change or something of that sort. Anytime there is a minor disruption in the credits for the program, some people will inevitably get upset. Is that a good thing? And that's the first thing I'm going to throw out there is it necessary every once in a while to give people that disruption for the sake of saying, no, we want to make sure that you're paying close attention to this. If you're getting upset and you're speaking out about it, then we know you were watching and you were following, because that gives us the statistical analysis that we need to make future changes.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, the whole show is built on change. I mean, we never would have made it to the second Doctor had someone not had the idea of, wait, we can change this up and people might get upset, but we can keep the show going. And that's the important thing, is that if we were still watching, you know, the same stories that we had with William Hartnell, it never would have made it to 52 years. You know, you have to change, and part of that is bringing in new actors. I mean, name one Doctor that everyone can agree on was absolutely fantastic. It's not going to happen. You know, you've got David Tennant, which is beloved, but then you've got people who are like, I really didn't care for him. I like the guy that came after him, you know. And so it's just one of those things that you have to change them in order to, you know, people right now, I know we've got friends that are, you know, as soon as Capaldi got casted, they tapped out for a while, and they figure they'll come back later on. And, mm-hmm. you know, even though he's turned out to be a phenomenal doctor, it's, you know, people's taste varies, and so you really do have to take that into account.
Yeah, as popular as Matt Smith was, a lot of people tapped out when he took over.
Absolutely. I was nearly one of them.
Yeah, because he wasn't my doctor, so why am I going to bother watching?
Or anything reminiscent of my doctor. And that's something that we wanted to make sure that we got a chance to kind of take apart as the recycling bin comes rolling through the room. And that's the fact that association with character archetypes, while absolutely valid within your enjoyment of the program, is something that you have to understand. The core construct of the show since Troughton's takeover is that it is fundamentally built to be modular and interchangeable. It's built into the core tenets of the program so that you can have something where your setting changes, your time frame changes, your cast changes, your tone will change. Even within Troughton's era, there were opportunities where, when they were first getting a feel for, will we be able to put someone else into Bill Hartnell's role and get something that the audience will appeal to? And they were concerned as to whether or not time trips were going to be necessary, or did we have to go off-world so that we gave them something that was absolutely fantastical? So you had fewer historical pieces and more off-world pieces. I'm thinking post-war games, of course. But this is a matter of them playing with the format. So, and that continues to this day. So you're dealing with something right now where, and this is something I want to be able to get to eventually, but it's talking about, you talk about in things like the programming industry or something like that, for anyone who's gotten into the dot-com field, you talk about incremental changes. You want to make sure, or marketing and advertising, if you want to make sure that something is working, don't change too many things at once. Because if something works or doesn't work, you don't know what to attribute it to if you changed too many elements. So that was a big concern on the Matt Smith changeover, because you changed Doctor, you changed companions, you changed entire production crews.
You changed the TARDIS. I mean, there was nothing that was the same.
That was a huge, huge gamble. But they went into it from a business perspective and said, there's a demographic that we need to lock down, and that's our teen to 20s. male and female, we need to get our core youth audience back. That's why you had the family TARDIS, you had the pond life. And it was a gamble, but it worked for the ratings.
Right, and because everything was new at that point, it gave a lot of new viewers a good starting point. You know, new doctor, new companion, new stories, new tone, jump in here.
Mm-hmm. And which is why we've said on numerous occasions that though it may not be one of our personal favorite episodes, if you want to introduce somebody to Who, in general, and I'm talking classic and new, you may hand them 11th Hour.
Because Rose is not a good first episode to watch.
It isn't. It honestly isn't. As much as I love what Russell did to revitalize the series, it doesn't give an adequate explanation to someone who does not understand some of the core constructs. And 11th Hour does. Whether you really care for Amy or not, whether you really care for Flappy Hands Matt Smith or not, I'm sorry, I have to say it. And I love the guy, but it's still. But it does do an excellent job of breaking down. Okay, we're going to back up to 15,000 feet, give you a quick synopsis. We're even going to give you a quick visual nod to the entire backstory where he walks through the holographic, you know, walkthrough of all the doctors and things. And for anybody who wants to find out more, if they use that as their entry point and they said, well, who the heck are all these other faces that were up here when they were talking to this Prisoner Zero thing? And they go and seek it out, great, job done. So the nature of that change and a huge gamble like that, that's probably one of the biggest risks I think the show has taken since, I don't want to say since the Troughton takeover, because there were some other genuine gambles they took during the classic era that could have seriously jeopardized the program.
The Twin Dilemma. Sorry.
Fair. All right. JNT notwithstanding. One of the things that we wanted to make sure that we addressed had to do with, and again, this has to do with whether it be a tonal change or a cast change or a format change, because, and we mentioned format changes because especially what we've seen within Series 9 right now, the return to the longer story format, episodes within a story. It took me a long time to try and explain Doctor Who to new Whovians, and that I wasn't talking about, well, did you see, you know, season blah blah blah, episode blah? And I said, do you mean story or episode? And I had gotten locked into that nomenclature because of classic conditioning, where you were dealing with anywhere from 2 to 8 episodes within a story. You needed longer to tell that tale. And the fact that they're returning to that now is something that a lot of viewers are tripping over.
Yeah.
Some are really enjoying it.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's. I know that there are a lot of people that are really hung up on the fact that we have actual cliffhangers this season. You know, it's one of those things like, well, no, that's not how the show works. I'm supposed to have a result at the end of the episode, and that's not the case. And there are some people who are new Whovians that just they get hung up on it and they can't stand it. So, it's. I mean, I think that it makes for better storytelling, but that's my personal opinion.
Well, not just a lack of resolution, but you don't even get a scenes from next week. You get a true, to be continued, done. You don't even get a tip of the hand into what the next week is going to be, which I love. Which I know some people that absolutely hate spoilers of any nature are pleased to see. I don't even want to, la 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 la. Surprise me. Tell me a story.
I actually think what's really kind of interesting is that they're releasing these snippets ahead of time. And those snippets are usually the first anywhere from 2 to 4 minutes of the next episode in 30-second snippets. And if you actually look at them, you go on like YouTube or whatever. I don't know. I don't know what YouTube or whatever is. I've been looking at the Facebook page of Doctor Who and or hitting them, or Twitter is what I usually look at. I can actually go on and see them. I actually get an idea of what's going to happen the week before by looking at these snippets. So I get to see the previews because I'm the person that likes to figure things out. I'm the person that looks for all the foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. I'm the person that's watched every single BBC America Breakfast with Baker on Sunday mornings because I like to see why Moffat's been giving us these backstories because he's giving us something. BBC America has been giving us these Breakfast with Baker because they're giving us a backstory for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
There's something there.
Okay.
Okay. I really believe that. And I believe that there's all this connecting of all these stories and this backstory connecting in Capaldi's series season is there's a reason for it.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. There absolutely has been a lot of tipping back to the classic stuff and bringing that forward because it's a there's a lot of history to tap into, and I've mentioned on the show before. I've got a friend that I recently just got started on the show, and she's finally caught up, and she's just ravenous about it. And just this week, after we watched the series opener with Magician's Apprentice and The Witch's Familiar. You know, I mentioned the genesis of the Daleks and how it was so very similar and there were so many references and things like that. And just this week, she finally sat down to watch it. And I'm like, that's what this is about. You make those references so that you can, introduce the new ones to the classic stories and kind of spark that curiosity and bring that stuff forward. So I'm absolutely loving the fact that that's happening.
But it's not force-fed.
Yeah,
and it's something for those audience members who are more casual about it, who don't care to dig into the backstory, can still enjoy the present tense. Present tense in a Doctor Who. What a novel idea. Living for the moment in a show about chronological disruption? God damn! I'm gonna take the mic in the back. Keep chatting for a second.
Okay. I would like to think that we're getting all these nods to classic because they're getting ready to introduce something big from classic. Like, I don't know. Maybe bring back Barbara. That would be cool. Carol Ann Ford said today she'd do it if they asked. I'm just saying.
It was confirmed. You know, anything Peter Capaldi asks for, he gets. So
Capaldi wants it.
Yeah, exactly.
He has a really good shot at it.
Right, and we know he wants it, so.
So that's why. Yeah, we're just going to go ahead and confirm that right now.
Yep.
You're the first here. Susan is coming back.
Susan. Yeah, I said Barbara. My bad.
Yeah.
More than me.
I've been drinking all day.
It's one of those female characters. They're all interchangeable back in the classic era.
Wow. I'm going to stick to
it. Do it.
This is not entertaining.
Boom.
I like the fact that you mentioned it is a business, but they got to change it slowly, but it needs to change, and they seem to be the two things are conflicting with one another. Because me personally, I think it needed to change faster. That was one of the things I liked about 11, was everything was just thrown up in the air. I mean, one of my favorite episodes, which was basically almost like a standalone, was Cold War. Because they brought back the Ice Warriors. I mean, I'm tired of seeing Dalek. And then, boy, we'll fill in Cybermen. Dalek.
They got to keep the rights.
Come on, man. There's got to be other villains.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I personally love Cold War as well. We talked about this. I think we all really appreciated that Tin Can sub episode because of the encapsulated nature of it, and it was something that got back to an extremely classic feel.
Yeah, it was one of the few times that Gatiss didn't completely drop the ball.
That's Jay at Gallifrey Public Radio.
Bring it on! I'm right here.
Come at me, bro.
Great book.
So, all right. Well, let's talk about the tonal changes. Okay, the idea of going back, whether it be explicitly going back to a classic format in terms of mystery, 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 monster reveal, reaction, 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 solution. Okay, which may be spread across multiple episodes before, or you might try to fit in within, 42 minutes. But tonal changes that we're dealing with right now, is that something that the audience should necessarily be prepared for? Or is it a matter of, if you're invested in the characters, if you're invested in the arc, if you're invested in the franchise, whether it takes the story of one episode or five to tell the tale, should it matter?
No, it shouldn't. I mean, that's something that the story needs to be the first thing. That has to come first before how many episodes do we have, how many episodes can we spare for it? You need to make sure that you have a story that is compelling and then work everything else around it. And sure, you might have to change the story to fit certain constraints and stuff, but as long as you keep the story the center, I think that is the most important thing. And as long as we can do that, I'm willing to accept changes or sacrifices in other areas or things like that, as long as we can have those solid stories that aren't just fluff trying to get us to the series finale so that we can have the one two-parter for the series.
Okay. But I was finding that's what with the Dalek and the Cybermen, it's just filler. It's just filler right now because they can't find anything to put forward. I would love to see like a pure historical piece, no aliens, no sci-fi, just drama. Like, TARDIS leaves and I'm in the Stone Age and I have to find a way to survive, not be killed by a caveman, and then find a way to get back to the TARDIS. That would be drama, you know? You gotta get home. You're basically screwed.
That's something that could be an interesting dynamic. The return to almost a first Doctor feel, where it was a matter of historical exploration, and it was a matter of trying to, you know, you were treating it as almost an educational experience for the audience. And the drama involved is the fact that you are in a life or death situation where tech or hand-wavy science isn't there to save you.
I was going
to
say, that sounds remarkably like an unearthly child in the Daleks.
Yeah.
That's how the show started.
Are we at a point right now where we can take that kind of a chance for the sake of an episode or two?
Yeah.
And throw it up. Knowing that you'll be able to return to your happy love relationship formats and who's Clara pining out now. Fair. Yeah, something else.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great to me too, but on the opposite end of the spectrum, I'd love to see world building with an alien planet with no humans or even humanoids.
When is the last time we saw an alien world that didn't have Daleks on it?
Akaten.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking too. But I mean, that's a great example though. Is that, you know, that was a, you know, almost a world building thing. You know, we had brand new aliens all over the place, and no Daleks, no Cybermen, nothing like that. And yet, the stakes were minimal because we didn't have anyone that we cared about aside from the Doctor and Clara being there. What was there really to care about?
And they could leave.
Yeah.
Peace out.
Sorry, deuces.
See you in a week.
Deuces, bitches.
You guys, we're gone.
Well, okay. So we're dealing with a lot of different facets right now. There are a lot of different pieces that could potentially be shifted on the board. And I think that's one of the things that we may lose sight of at any given moment is the fact that from a showrunner's perspective, and it was interesting, we sat in and got a chance to listen to some of the folks from Happiness Patrol and some of the other group that were doing their discussion about the people versus Stephen Moffat, which is, you know, any Whovian convention that you go to is going to have some panel of that sort as to whether or not we're going to crucify the bastard for everything that he's
or
done.
Or deify him.
Yeah, exactly. So, but one of the points that keeps coming up is the fact that you have to bear in mind that there is more going on than just the story. There is the ratings. And I know I'm not harping on the fact that they have to be mindful of business, but whether you want to admit it or not, ratings are at a low point within the native broadcast audience in the UK right now, which is going to be the nature of what happens when you go through a major shift that they've done. Granted, at the same time, within the U.S. viewing audience, it is at an all-time spike. So globally, the numbers for the program are doing exceptionally well. The BBC doesn't care because it's not their numbers. What does this mean for where we proceed, since we know that Peter's going to be with us through Series 10? The companion position is up for grabs. The tonal position and direction for the show is to be determined. And there are a lot of other pieces that can be shifted on the board. I'm not saying we need to make any predictions as to you know, what we feel the next path of action should be, but we can see where some of the obvious dangers are. People have said things like, I want a non-human companion. As awesome as that may be, you know, to have a I'm not going to say chameleon, because I'm not going to go android here on you. But to have, you know.
Someone who's not a, you know.
Have a data. Everybody. And you get a data. And you get a data. Everybody gets datas.
I got Dalek.
So another dollar to keep the Terry Nation people happy. No, but well, as awesome as that sounds, that's way too big of a gamble for them. Because they're losing their touch point. You need your audience touch point. Male, female, young, middle-aged, older age. You need a touch point for the audience. That's the nature of what the companions construct was originally intended for.
Well, I mean, the argument could be had that the audience or that the companion is just basically someone that's there to give the doctor someone to explain his clever plan to. So at that point, yeah, you can have pretty much anyone that just doesn't understand what's going on. So why not have it be an alien or, you know, someone who's not in their 20s from London, you know?
Peter Capaldi has shown he can explain himself to an empty room.
And he will get an opportunity to do that in episode 11.
I say bring back handles. Handles.
Shut your fat mouth. I don't need a lunchbox telling me. But they've had opportunities, you know, in the past where you take Romana, where you've got someone who is an intellectual equal. And they realized very quickly that even in that dynamic, because you didn't have the opportunity to explain it to the common viewer, they had to bring in a Duggan or somebody of that sort to be able to break it down to. Granted, Duggan was busy thumping people, but that's just what Duggan does. So I don't want to make predictions because we're going to have another episode far later when we get in our season break where we'll make all the predictions and all the hypotheses in the world because that's what we're good at. But what are some of the things that we know have to be maintained, like it or leave it? What has to stay there? If we know Capaldi is staying at the console, not the Feely console.
The squidgy console.
We're not sticking our fingers in the squidgy console and thinking about...
He's titillating the fronds.
Think happy thoughts and you can fly.
That, you know, that adds a lot more to that line from Sarah Jane of, does he still stroke bits of the console?
which bits were you talking about?
So what are the elements that have to persist? Win, lose, or draw, they've got to stay there for the sake of maintaining the viability of the program as a business.
Well, if you're going to have an older doctor, you have to have younger companions, probably, since the multiple companions was much more successful ratings-wise than just Clara was.
I'm going to ask you that. I'm going to flip that around on you. Could Capaldi, seeing just within the last couple of episodes how he functioned with things like having to educate the room, as he had his representatives of UNIT, he had alien races in the room, he had his own companion in the room, he had third parties, Osgood, in the room. I'm gonna lump her in with UNIT because she's her own thing. Could we be at a point where we could have something that is the presence where Capaldi kind of pulls on that Pertwee and Hartnell kind of gravitas, but at the same time can have that professor aspect of Davison or McCoy and get back to the classroom TARDIS. Multiple individuals, no relationships, no hanky-panky in the console room, but multiple individuals who have to be there for the experience and the education.
Right.
Everyone's talking about.
Yeah, we can't have any.
Three different panels, and that's what everybody is talking about.
Pick some of the mic. Talk to me again.
I've been in three different panels, and that's what everyone's talking about, is having companions that have no relationship to each other or to the doctor. It's not this romance thing, that it's more going towards that classroom thing where the dynamic is that he is the teacher, that he is the guy that bounces off of things, the almost the Sherlock-y kind of concept where he's, you know, asking the question, like, and listen, you know, where he used Clara as the person to bounce information off of. And then when he didn't have Clara, he wanted to ask someone else. He asked the janitor, I think, a question about something. But that's what he does best, you know, and that's what he kind of thrives on, the doctor thrives at. And I think that's where they need to go. I mean, I really believe that that's where they need to work at it. Because I know personally, when I heard that Capaldi was going to be the doctor on my own level, because I was a tenant person, and I kind of waffled with Smith.
You don't say.
Well, you know, I blew
blew out my shoulder, and I have all these beautiful dresses half sewn, and I couldn't sew them all. But I have all these beautiful dresses and all these beautiful fabrics, so everything's up on the sewing tables and nothing's sewn. So I had a punt to wear what I'm wearing today.
That's right. David would wear beautiful dresses too if he could.
I think he has,
pants,
actually.
So I couldn't wear the pants to go with the suit, so I had to wear the stupid skirt and do the old girly stand shoes. But anyhow.
But to your point about the idea of Crowley being the professor for the
right.
TARDIS classroom, I think especially now that we've been able to round the corners on his doctor,
yeah.
And he's not as spiky and abrasive as he was at the outset.
I love spiky doctor.
I have to tell you something. I actually adore him. When I first found out that he was going to be the doctor, I was like, I'm boycotting him. I'm not going to watch him. I'm mad. I'm pissed off. I don't want some old fart.
I know somebody that did a podcast about pre-hating.
Yes. And then I said, you know what? And my mother and I sat down and went, you know, we're going to give the guy a chance. And the first episode, I went, I love him.
Yeah.
I absolutely love the guy. And the more I see him, the more I love him. And I think he's absolutely brilliant. And I'm going to tell everyone, go watch the Larry King interview with Capaldi. It is brilliant. Watch all 45 minutes, not that stupid snippets about what girl he first kissed and then and get taken out of context. Watch the whole interview. He's brilliant. But he talks about BBC America. And he talks about the fact that BBC America is actually in a lot of trouble. The fact is that BBC America is actually not being taken seriously. And the fact is the entire corporation is actually in trouble. And he's talked about it very, very seriously with Larry King. And he's very, very worried about the corporation itself. That it's a brilliant corporation. It's wonderful. It's the best corporation that's been in all of the UK. But the fact is that it's in trouble. And that people need to know that it's in trouble and that they need to get behind BBC America and support it. Very interesting.
Valid point, and something I've been hearing quite a bit as well. So, because of the fact they're dealing with the cross-continental
nature. And stuff like that.
Precisely. So, I guess one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we got a chance to be able to chat over had to do with the nature of fans that feel abandoned. When one of these changes occur and you get a number of people who say, that I have to tap out. I'm just not relating to the program. And whether or not they are the ones who say, I'm signing off on it entirely. I'm done with this. Or we'll get people who say, I'm gonna put it on pause. I'm going to wait until something occurs where I
new doctor or new companion, whatever it is that's turned them off.
Or just some content changes, you know, whether it be just a matter of, okay, well, they're getting into something where they're doing some Viking stuff. Okay, well, I like a lot of historical, you know, Dark Ages material, so maybe I'll tap in. I love Game of Thrones. Maisie Williams is in it. All right, maybe I'll give it another look, even though I'm not really fond of Capaldi or whatever the case may be. So it brings them back for one nature or another. So what I wanted to talk about was the fact that Is there a matter of etiquette with dealing with people who take the hard approach? The change has been something that rankled them so much that they drop mic and walk away. Do you bother chasing them down?
Absolutely.
You do?
I did. I chased my kid down.
Okay.
My kid was like, no, not Peter Capaldi. No.
All right. Here's the question.
She's 19.
So she's 19.
She loved Matt Smith.
Of course, because Matt Smith was cast for 19-year-olds.
Right.
And that was the demographic they were trying to make.
Because he was a 19-year-old.
I made her sit down and watch Peter Capaldi.
Okay.
And she went, oh, he's really good. You're right.
What did you show her specifically? Do you remember which episodes?
I started it from the very beginning.
Deep breath.
I made her watch the whole thing.
Okay.
I just said, you know, you gotta do this. You gotta watch it. And then this season, she came home for a couple of days after I had my surgery on my shoulder, and I said, this season's even better than the last season. It's so much better. You're gonna really, really love it. And of course, the first thing she did when she saw him come out playing guitar, she went, holy shit, this is hilarious. And I didn't think she liked the Sonic with the doggone sunglasses, because, you know, we're Sonic people, you know? This is very controversial. People either love it or hate it. I think it's great. I'm definitely one of those people that's like more to the right when it comes to stuff. I'm more liberal. I love the sunglasses. I think they're fucking hilarious.
Well, here's my problem with this.
Fucking
lame ass. I love them. I think they're funny because, you know what? When he was with Davros and he had to pick those suckers up. If it had been a sonnet, he never would have been able to do what he had to do. But because they were a pair of sunglasses, he could do what he had to do to get himself out of his thicket.
Here's my problem with those goddamn sunglasses. I was hoping when we went to something other than the sonic screwdriver, we were going to quit using it so much as a crutch. Because, you know, Matt Smith was like, look at my sonic screwdriver. You see my sonic screwdriver? You want to see my sonic screwdriver? I was hoping that maybe we were going to see less of the sonicking. But no, he's whipping those things off and on all the time. The sonic sunglasses, sticking them in USB ports, walking around, just holding one of them up like a monocle. Like,
I love the USB ports. It's so awesome.
I've stopped some weird USB
ports. Kid, we're not going that far, dude.
After dark.
It's fine, but geez, keep it in your pants.
USB port with the Fisher King? That was like bloody.
But here's the flip side of that. A number of people will also say that as a result of all the components that Capaldi, by his own recommendation, have been able to add to the character. Because this is the glam rock thing, the David Bowie era, that was his nature. You know, the 70s punk scene that defined who he was. And it, what he considers to be his heyday, what he doesn't even realize, but his heyday is right at the now. But those are the elements that he wants to infuse his doctor with. But some people are railing against that. You know, and I've heard comments like, the whole aging punker routine is getting tired, and there's too many aspects of it, and his frumpy clothes, when he first came out in Series 8, he was wearing this kick-ass... You know, a three-quarter length coat and the white shirt, and now he's wearing these tired, stretched-out sweatshirts.
The hoodie with the holes in it.
Looks like he just fell out of a dumpster. He fell out of a dumpster routine, and I'm like, wow, that's okay. Maybe they've gone a little far with it. Maybe they've allowed him to have too much free will in how he's portraying his doctor. They need to bring it back a little bit. But we're dealing with super fans. Writing for super fans, casting super fans, and they're tearing off with it.
Well, I mean, I think the problem with the super fan is they're a super fan. And what you gotta understand is this whole show is about change. Now, you're not gonna always like the change, but that's the whole point of the show. When they first cast Peter Capaldi, I was like many people, I said, no effing way. All right. When I saw Craig Ferguson at night, I thought Craig Ferguson would have been a better doctor. I was like, damn, why didn't they have him, right?
I agree.
But you know what? I didn't see when everybody's like, Capaldi's awesome. It didn't dawn on me until he had that big old speech that brought a tear to my eye in the recent episode where he's like, oh, I don't want you to feel the pain that I felt and no more. So... he definitely has been acting, it's just, again, it brings it back to story, and people have to understand, there's got to be change. But the question is, do we stagnate on a certain point, or do we want to change that point, unless, of course, we're going to lose too much of the business? I don't think we'll lose too much of the business, but the problem is, they don't know which one works and which one doesn't work. It's like Rubik's Cube. You keep turning it, and maybe you get a side, but you haven't got the whole cube done yet. And then you're like, damn it, I gotta keep turning it, and you ruin that side that you got. And it's tough.
I just demonize
the showrunner. Does that mean that I glorify him? No. He's got the toughest job in the universe. He's gotta please a huge audience, super fans included, all of geekdom. And no matter what he does, he's going to get burned by somebody. And that sucks.
Well, it's because he's Stephen Moffat. I mean, there's always going to be that contingent that hates him no matter what he does.
But RTAD had the same problem, people.
You know what? I don't think RTD responded to it the way that Stephen Moffat does, though. I feel like Stephen Moffat, every time he opens his mouth, he incites riots.
Yeah, he's a little bit more verbal, yeah.
Well, I love that analogy. I'm totally going to steal that Rubik's Cube analogy because that's something where we have to be cognizant of the fact that there are so many facets to this, that we keep looking at it as people that love to get into the minutia, And we love to take it apart and really scrutinize how that episode was written through, how that character arc is developing. And we're looking at it down to that finest detail. A vast majority of the audience aren't staring at the stitches in the fabric as closely as we are. So you have to every once in a while, and the forest for the trees analogy is totally valid, because we may be at this point incapable of stepping back and saying, well, some people are just casually watching the show, and it has to be an entertaining show on a casual viewing.
Why?
If it's not entertaining on a casual viewing, it's not going to remain viable.
I know all those words, but that order confuses me. I can't follow that.
Okay. I'm going to break this down for you.
Let me break this down like a fraction.
I get that, and that's...
Make fun TV.
Well, here's the thing. Do you have to have every once in a while... Is it a matter of just mixing it up? So that over the course of a 12-episode season, you've got some things that really propel a greater storyline, but you need more canned adventures that are just fluff fun.
Yeah, let's talk about this season a little bit, because they committed so hard to the two-parters that's basically, it's all we've seen so far. The one that wasn't really a two-parter was two halves of a story, and I still think that those would have been better with something between them. Put a little distance between the first half of a Shielder's story and the second half of her story. But they had committed to this multi-part stories for the series. So, you know, you see the first half and you see the second half, and I need some of that. And
yeah, you do.
Yeah, I do.
We're interrupting Haley with this moonshine pouring interval.
So they create this character, and there's supposed to have been some time and some things have happened between when the Doctor sees her. But for the audience, you know, he made her immortal, and then he jumped ahead and she's an immortal. And we're seeing the consequences of that decision. I would like to have had some distance between what he did and the consequences of his action.
The thing is, do people want a broad church? Or do they want... I mean, I have to tell you, the second... I don't know what season it was, but Matt Smith had all these... It was like this disjointed season where it was like one show was like the Dolls, and the next show was...
Seven was a mess.
I hated that season.
Seven was, I think, a matter of a combination of experimentation and the fact that they had a very lopsided transition that they knew they were going to have to deal with.
Isn't that also a season when Moffat was working a lot on Sherlock?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that was, you had five episodes to see the ponds out, which, you know, everybody knew was coming, so we're all waiting for that, and nothing that comes before that really matters. And then you've got, you know, another eight episodes to introduce Clara, which they completely botched, in my opinion. But
it was that season just made me nuts, because it was just like, it was all fluffed. It was just like garbage. To me, it was a garbage season.
I would love to find individuals who actually say they genuinely enjoyed Series 7.
Yeah, good luck with that.
No, I'm curious, and I will bet that there are ones out there because they love the fact, oh, it was so random. Oh, you never knew what you were going to get from one week to the next.
Well,
yeah.
That's exactly what they were aiming for, was that whole one-shot adventure, the monster of the week. I mean, they had the movie posters, everything was that one. And that, you know, a lot of people really bucked at that, and that's...
You can do an adventure of the week, but the characters were inconsistent from one week to the next, especially Clara. You couldn't get to know this new companion because she wasn't the same from one week to the next. Mm.
I love the idea of the cliffhanger, because personally, it's like when you're watching any kind of series, it's like the show stops and there's like the story's going to continue on with something else. It's like Heroes Reborn. I mean, Heroes Reborn came out and it's like every week I know, oh shit, something else is going to happen. It's going to continue. And I love that. I love the fact that I'm going to be surprised. I love the fact that something else is going to happen that's going to make me think about it all week, that I'm going to look forward to something that's going to finish the story that started before.
That you can't bring in new
business gamble with something that needs to function at a certain level on a serial basis.
Then it's not such a big deal.
Yeah, but see, that's not even what I like. Yeah, the two-parters are cool and all, but I prefer, I guess it's Series 5 when they did this, where there is a story in each episode that, you know, it is all within that episode, but also every episode is building towards a larger story.
Exactly.
I love that kind of storytelling.
Yeah, see, one thing that I wouldn't mind seeing happen is similar to if anyone has watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes.
If you watch that show, definitely check out Haley's other podcast.
Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. available at legendsofshield.com.
A part of the Gunna Geek Network.
Done for the night.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is like one of my other favorite go-tos.
But that one has that,
I'm behind.
That weekly monster adventure thing, but it still has the thread that runs through, and sometimes it's something that runs throughout the season. Or sometimes it's just that little, the little teaser at the end, the little, like, oh, hey, everything's happy, and oh, crap, here's somebody else. And then they cut it, and that's what leads you into the next episode. And that might be all it takes. You have your one-shot adventure, but then you...
That one was Jay's corner.
To me, as long as each adventure, even though they could be singular, as long as they tie in to the story and carry you through to a common purpose, one thing that the Impossible Girl did was it carried through the whole season.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we had different adventures, it carried through the whole season.
They kind of did it in Series 8, too, with little Missy tags at the end of a few episodes. But I wish they had done a little bit more building that arc. Like, either... I said this in some podcasts, so other people have heard me say it, but do it more or do it less. I feel like the amount they did just left me wanting them to have done it more or less.
Yeah, putting them in there as just little stingers that were very disjointed from the episode in total, rather than something where, and it's an odd parallel to use, but the Madame Kavorian during Amy's pregnancy, that happened intermittently in the middle of stories. All of a sudden, the window opens. And,
what the fuck?
Who the hell's the eye patch, bitch? Who's that one?
And then they don't give you anything else, and you're just sitting there not paying attention to what's going on. Because you're like,
what the hell? Still could function within canned episodes, because it was this weird thing. But we're acclimated to weird things happening in Doctor Who, because it's a weird-ass show. And if you didn't pursue it for a couple of weeks and we were a casual viewer, it didn't disrupt your enjoyment of the story itself until you got to Good Man Goes to War or something of that sort, in which case it was given to you where you didn't even know. You could come into Good Man Goes to War and have never seen that woman before, but you knew within the first 9 minutes, okay, she's the big bad. Got it. Some weird shit's going on with Amy's baby. Okay, she's responsible for it. Oh, stealing babies. Stealing babies. Got it. Okay. I'm good.
Okay, she's the bad guy. Okay.
Got it. She's got an eye patch. Because one thing we've learned is that eye patches equals evil.
Yep. So,
look at
facial scars.
Universe Brigadier.
Well, you could also take topics and use the relevance of them. Like you said, stealing babies is something obvious that people could go, oh, shit, I mean, I think the continuity, everybody's going to always argue over continuity. I mean, one of my biggest complaints about The Great Intelligence was when Matt Smith, I believe it was Matt Smith, right? Mm-hmm.
In the Snowman, yep.
Yeah, and he doesn't recognize The Great Intelligence. He doesn't recognize, but yet he had adventures with The Great Intelligence. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, he could say, well, he forgot because he's a bajillion years old, but I mean, he continues to go against him, and he doesn't recall this is, the big bad that he fought back in the day.
Yep.
And I thought, dude, somebody dropped the ball there. They dropped the ball big time.
I loved the fact that they utilized The Great Intelligence because of the potential that particular adversary provided. It could have been utilized to a great extent. Now, they chose to just use it as a one and done and dismiss it. More's the pity. But it's an instance where I think, again, Moffat, Minchin, some of the other individuals within the production team want to be able to spark interest within the viewers to go back and seek some additional material if they choose to.
Well, that brings up a good point, though, that our friend Soleil brought up to us recently, that we had these two parts with the Zygons, and they've got this great... am I not picking up here?
No, you're good.
All right. you had these great villains that, you know, were classic era villains that, you know, had a history and things like that. And, you know, why in series one did we introduce the Slitheen to pose as humans when we already had a villain that was set up and could do that? So why do we need to, you know, invent these new villains that basically do the same thing? And I think a lot of that has to do with,
you know, it is the change in the show. You know, if you bring forward something that someone might have seen in their childhood that, you know, they tie it in with the old show or whatever, it's like, well, they might have an instant reaction of like, oh, that's from that show I used to see on PBS, and I'm checking out. You know, maybe not, the Slitheen might not have been the greatest villains to bring forward and try and win them over instead, but, you know.
You wait till they get reinvented in a couple of years.
The kids are going to love it.
At those 2022 Slitheens, they're going to be kick-ass. You have no idea.
You know, it...
The thing I found interesting was the whole Madame Pompadour thing with Deep Breath, and then you have Madame Pompadour with David Tennant, and then Tom Baker also talks about Madame Pompadour.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting how all three doctors all talk about Madame Pompadour.
Major historical milestones like that, iconic figures, are things that are always going to be an aspect that our production team love to tap into, because it's a, I'm not, the cash cow is a wrong term, but it's something where it's an immediate, you know, bookmark within the brain that says, okay, I know what you're referring to. You know, why did we do a Kill Hitler episode? Really? Did you need
to? What else
are
you going
to
do with a time machine?
Precisely. Why did it take 49 years to address that iconic time travel paradoxical issue?
Because somebody got bored and lazy. That's why.
That's Jay at Public Radio. Calvary Public Radio. So I guess one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we talk about is the reserving the right to take these kinds of risks. Okay. And the fact that knowing it's a business, knowing you need to take some chances, knowing that you have an audience you need to continue to cultivate. You know, you have a new generation that comes around that either really wants your Pons and your feely relationships and family aspects and lovey drama, that, as we started to discuss, classic or longer-term viewers that say, well, that's not the way it's been done. Look at any industry, any business where technology needs to evolve. Okay, we need to get you paperless. We need to shift you off of this sort of thing. We need to start moving you things. You know, we need to transition all of your software to the cloud. Oh, the cloud. But it's an evolution. It's something that needs to happen because things are passing you by. So as much as we want to be able to name check and gratify classic Whovians or long-term Whovians who have invested so much in this program for so long, we need to be aware of the fact that there is an audience that needs to be won over that has not had that backstory and doesn't even right. necessarily care about it. They may find it on their right. own. If we win them over, great.
But at the same time, the other side of that coin is, in doing that, do you really want to introduce new Coke? I mean, it's definitely okay. a balance there. You have to figure out, what is it about this show that works? How can we, you know, build on that and create new things without completely fucking it up? You know?
You see, I'm as much of a continuity whore as anybody. But if you can tell a great story by ignoring a piece of continuity, then tell a great story.
By the way, I am absolutely cutting continuity out of that phrase and putting that as your intro.
Yeah, I'm just a whore.
Look, you know what? If we can't put Get the Fuck Out because we'll put Kier's mom off the podcast, then I bet you're not going to put
Mom
more.
Mom stopped listening about 4 weeks ago.
Sorry, Kier's mom.
Sorry, Kier's mom.
The thing is that when I first started Doctor Who, it was with Rose Tyler 9, 2005.
Sure.
I was completely oblivious to the old stuff. I mean, I tried to watch the old stuff originally, and I went, this is too hokey. I don't like it. Period. Then I came to the convention last year, and I sat next door to a couple people that were old-timer Whovians, and they talked to me about it. And then I sat on panels, and I listened to all the old-time Whovians, and I went, I gotta get into this. And so I did marathons on Netflix, Prime, and watched every piece of old-time Who that I could get my hands on. And I went, I am in love with this stuff.
Sure.
So I became the person who loved it. But until, I mean, I spent 6 years, six, 7 years, what, since 2009 when we first got introduced to it?
Okay.
How long is that? It's now 2015, so 6 years. Not caring.
No.
One
2005, it's been a decade.
Our introduction, yeah.
Okay.
Couldn't get it until 2009. But not 6 years practically before I could have cared less.
I'm probably in about the same boat as you are. I know Matt Smith was already the doctor when I went back and watched everything that I could on Netflix. And since then, I've started to go back to the classic stuff. I haven't gotten through all of it yet, but I'm working on it.
Matt Smith hadn't come in yet. David
yeah.
was.
Right. It's funny because I found this as a comic book collector in the day that they're so afraid of like having so much backstory that it's so massive that fans will, or new fans will not appreciate. They'll be like, no, I can't. Spider-Man's up to number 800. I can't go back and read them all.
I started Marvel Comics in 1961.
The exact opposite, because if you put a good story out there, people will want to go back and want to read. And then that's when you make the money off of selling the reprints.
Okay. So,
but the thing is, with that, you're going to make the, you know, let's say $70-$80 off that one person who wants the reprints, but you're excluding the, you know, 40 or 50 people who would jump into it because there isn't it. Because I completely understand the completionist viewpoint. I mean, that's how I am. It's like, no, got to start from the beginning and just work
weird
my way through.
Geeks.
I don't care if I run into the gunslingers. I'm going to plow through.
Yeah, but I find that it's not like I'm saying that we should cater to people having to go back. I'm saying that this whole fear, this terror that they people will not go back is unfounded. I think it's more founded that we just have to grab new viewers.
You know,
grab
it was
new viewers. They will fall in love with the show because the show is what? Change.
Yeah.
That's
well, it was Stan Lee that said every comic book is somebody's first comic book. So you should always, even if it's building on a previously existing story, you should always tell a story that stands on its own.
Absolutely.
So you can do an episode in Modern Who that builds on an existing villain from Classic Who or expands on a story from Classic Who, but as long as it's a strong story that stands on its own, then a new audience can appreciate it.
Again, I'll go back to something like Cold War, which you could come into. Oh, I love it. You could come into this cold.
Oh,
what you did there?
Here.
Boom. Get in the box.
Go stand in the
shame.
Corner. You are done.
I'm out, bitches. No, but that's something where there are obviously classic underpinnings, classic tone. All right, most of the supporting characters, you know, Claire's totally ancillary in that thing. It's all about your sub crew at that point, particularly your engineer, a character name eluding me at the moment. If someone could pull it off the top of their head, I'm going to give you a friggin' prize. But who is, you know, with his Ultravox.
Ultravox,
yes. Ultravox, mate. But that's something where, again, if you chose to go back and find out why it was the doctor was so concerned about this, great. Then you've got material you can tap into. If you could not care, I hate getting that expression wrong. If you could not care less about going back, you've still got a solid story.
Or look at the most recent episode, the
Zygatus.
He got one. How many episodes has
yeah,
he done?
Yeah, one
got
point.
You talk to me after tomorrow night.
Okay.
Oh,
but go back to the most recent episode, Zygon Inversion. Kate Lethbridge-Stewart had a line. What was it? Five rounds, rapid fire.
Five rounds, rapid.
Okay. I, as a new viewer, had no idea that was a reference. But, you know, you classic viewers could scream your panties off.
I squeed my pants.
Changed my clothes.
But as a modern viewer, I came in and I was just like, oh, this is a good episode. I'm really enjoying this story. I bet that's a reference to something. The guys are going to tell me what it means.
Oh, that's such an odd line. Why would they put that in there and give it so much time?
Well, like there was a pause there. You're like, that means something. Kier's going to tell you exactly what that means.
From the Midwest, she hears this sound from New England.
I thought it was a train for a minute, but it was coming from the wrong direction.
I don't know the reference. Help me out.
The reference Five Rounds Rapid comes from her father, Brigadier Alistair Lethbridge Stewart, who actually gave an order to one of his unit soldiers when they were dealing with an adversary to fire at them five rounds rapid. And it became sort of his, it wasn't even a catchphrase, but it was something that became this iconic, the way that unit approached the situation. Right. Go at it full force, go at it quickly, go at it hard, deal with the situation. And that encompassed what the brig was all about.
How do you deal with
the
dollar?
I'm getting five a little goosebumpy rapid. Talking about the brig right now, so I'm going to step back for just a second.
Here, you want to scoot behind the table there?
So yeah, is that a sonic screwdriver?
Which episode? Which one?
Damon. D-A-E-M-O-N-S. The proper spelling.
So, that just to...
Let's see if I can look for that now.
The interesting thing is I heard that in that same episode that they referred to a minor character who had the same last name as Osgood, and therefore they alluded to the fact that she might be related to that character. Now, I don't know how true that is. I'd have to go back and watch.
We've all proven that the BBC only has 12 actors and that Britain only has 12 last names.
Very true.
Well, even when hyphenated.
Particularly when hyphenated. Yeah.
Father.
It is. It's from that Anglo-Saxon tongue.
Yeah, I think for me the biggest change between Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat was just I grew up on Classic Who, and it wasn't until sort of Janet Fielding had actually pointed it out that when she first started in Legopolis, her aunt died, and they never really addressed it. And she never really got sad about it. And there was no sort of emotional content to that. And to me, the biggest difference between, or the biggest change between the two eras was that lack of emotional development between characters. Even if it's not the lovey-dovey, you know, in love with the doctor stuff, it's that there's no emotional backdrop to these characters.
Wasn't then or isn't now?
Isn't now.
Really?
The way I see things. Yeah.
I would argue the contrary. I would say right now, because of the fact that you have Stephen Moffat as one of your primary final edit points, and Moffat's strength, if you've seen Coupling, or if you've seen any of his projects outside of the sci-fi scope, are entirely relationship and emotional based. He loves being able to play with that. And we've talked about in the cast a number of times, when you want to talk feels, you ask Moffat to grab the pen. When you want to talk action...
You kick him out of the country and tell him to go sit on a beach and ignore everything for a week.
Here, go work on Sherlock for a while.
Here's a Mai Tai.
The Ponds lose their child, and it really doesn't seem to affect them.
Well, because Matt Smith runs off and is like, oh, I know where she is. Don't worry, I got this.
Yeah,
and then doesn't.
Child would still be slightly more affected by it.
Yeah, she seems more concerned about what the doctor's up to the next time we see her than what happened to my baby.
That may
well,
be
that's
a
the
character
was unbalanced.
Flaw. Well, precisely. Her priorities may have been entirely out of whack. And in fact, I'm not a huge Amy Pond fan. By
you know what? I'm just not realizing she should be on an episode of Maury. I didn't know I was pregnant.
I don't know. One day I took.
And then it was just, I knew there was a baby.
She's incorrigible on self.
So, all right. Before we get too long-winded here, because we're actually, you know, we can't just sit around, and I'm actually recording with pants on, which is completely out of the ordinary for me.
But thankful.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys are lucky.
Us not so much.
So let's go ahead and start to wrap this up. But you know, I think that it's one of those things that change is part of the show. You have to have change in order for the show to function, in order for it to be able to carry on for 50 years, you know, without completely, you know, derailing and dying. So you know, it's one of those things that it's dangerous and scary, and a lot of times highly inflammatory.
I'm sorry. I'm a theater dork, so if any of you have ever seen the musical Urinetown, there's a line in it where Bobby Strong is talking to little Sally, and she's like, things are going to change, Bobby, aren't they? Change is scary. It's like a cold wind that blasts you in the face. And she's literally, yes, literally. And it predates Archer by like 5 years, so they were so far. Anyway, yes, change, scary change. Sorry.
I am notorious for saying change is bad. Just because.
We fear change.
Because it's not about improvement.
I like change.
I do too. I'm just an asshole.
I change my room all the time and change my furniture.
The thing that we need to understand moving forward is that, you know, change is going to happen. We can't look at the Zygon inversion and think, this is the perfect Doctor Who episode. It never needs to deviate from this. I want this every week for the rest of my life, and then I'll be happy.
And 4 years from now, Jay will be the only person watching Doctor Who.
Yeah. She'll be with me.
I will have done it by then.
And we've talked about this, too.
I don't bitch about it the whole damn time.
I'm going to predict lines. And now he's going to say this. And then.
No, and then.
Wow, that's really bad references. But we've talked about things like, yeah, you're gonna make a flip like that. You're gonna bring a character back from the dead. By the way, kudos to Stephen Moffat for actually learning how death works this season.
Wait, death? It's a permanent thing.
It's closer.
What?
It's definitely a little bit closer than we had.
Right. Well, Danny Pink, dead as a doornail.
Well, except for that part where he talked to us through the cloud thingy.
That's fine. So he's on my thumb drive. But the whole idea of the fact that that these changes, while he may feel it necessary to temper the blow from time to time, you make a major disruption, people get all, I'm concerned, I don't want to lose that character yet, I don't want Osgood to be gone. We'll bring her back for a little bit. We'll give you a story that tells you that she's still out there even though you won't see her anymore. It's the riding off into the sunset ending that he's now going to be giving a number of characters, which will satisfy some viewers, will irritate others, but honestly, there has not, you know, we talk about change in general, there is not a single thing that you're going to be able to do to make any sort of a contextual modification in the status quo that will not upset someone. It has to. But I guess the kind of the point, and one of the things we want to bring out of this entire discussion was the fact that if it does upset someone, call that job done. Because you've got someone so invested in the material that it bothers them that you've shaken the box a little bit. And I think if you've done that, and if people actually speak up about it, you know, pat yourself in the back, because you've gotten people locked into your material.
Well, I think that, I mean, the big thing is just moving forward is that we have to look at change as inevitable and look at the exciting part of it. You know, look at the, you know, hey, this is a chance to run into an episode like the Zygon Inversion or get another David Tennant. Or, you know, if you're insane, you know, we might get Rings of Akaten. I don't know. It's, you know.
We know people that really love Rings of Akaten.
We
that,
do.
Yeah.
I two of
all them insane. But
people, plural. Actual, two of them.
But yeah, it's definitely something that, you know, we need to start embracing as a fandom instead of railing against before we ever even possibly can gather what it might mean for us. So, you know, change is part of the show. We have to accept that and just, and you know, revel in it. And know that if it doesn't turn out to be something that you absolutely love, know that more change is coming, because that's something we can't get away from.
And chances are very good that certain aspects that you miss will come around again.
Because you're going to run into another fanboy that gets in control of the show and says, hey, this is something I love too.
You wait until my day comes when I see Nicholas Briggs take over. It's going to take years, because he's not ready to take over.
He doesn't
want to
do it.
He said explicitly, we talked to him at Galley 1 last year, and he said he does not want the job if it were offered to him because he doesn't feel prepared for it. Yes. But you give him a couple of years, you know, give him an opportunity to get...
Let him do 50 more Big Finish productions.
Which will take about...
About 4 months.
Yeah, about 4 months. 50 productions, 4 months. Yeah. But
I'll have that done by Tuesday.
But... And again, I'm going so far off on this. This is for my Canadians. So, as Neil Peart and Rush once quoted, no changes are permanent, but change is. Nothing can stay still. So yes, disruptions are going to happen, things are going to irritate you, but if you really love the content, it's going to come around again. Stick with it. You know, obviously, we, you know, we'll tell anybody, whether it's people that have said, well, you know, I haven't watched since I watched the first two episodes of this series and it didn't really click with me, so they're queuing up on my DVR. Maybe I'll watch them at some point, and that's great. But we've got other folks that have said, oh God, I'm done, I tapped out, middle of series 8, new doctor, poo, spiky old punk rocker. But we know that as soon as they catch wind of the fact that there has been some sort of a dynamic shift, they'll be back, because the show itself is so addictive, because of the fact that we know that anyone who's watched it for more than one of these changes knows that it has the ability to go anywhere. So they'll come back to it. They will come back to it. So don't poo-poo them. Don't even bother fighting with them too hard. Just you know, placate them. Let them know that's great. Okay, it doesn't click with you right now. You're not signed up on the show, right? You'll come back to it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's an old thing. Every song that exists is somebody's favorite song. Every episode that is out there is somebody's favorite episode. There's some element in there that clicks with somebody.
Except for Fear Her.
If we do, we get a large enough sample group, we will find the person who's like, oh my God, Fear Her, I love
and
every bit of
that. The people you know are going to wind up shooting up school.
I'm going to find three of them this weekend. But we'll defend Fear Her to Jay. By the way, if our Patreon, our first Patreon level?
No, it's the last one. It's the highest. I am not.
No. The highest is your Mark Gatiss appreciation arc.
Okay.
So we set up this Patreon account that said, you know, if we get the sponsorship
for our audience.
I think it was level one or level two.
Level two is Fear Her.
Yes. What was level one?
Level one is Day of the Doctor, because I'm going to be...
Level
one is we do this live commentary of Day of the Doctor, and we just basically squee our pants off and whatnot. but level two is a punishment level where we have to really, really love Fear Her.
No, we don't have to love it.
We have to love it. I'm the Pollyanna on this cast. I got the pigtails to prove it.
But, you know, to what I
love crayons. Therefore, I love crayon drawings. I'm all prepared.
How many crayons do you have in
your box? 64. They're all darling. 63 and a half. Because I broke the black one.
It's on the green ones, too. So
they taste like green.
They taste like green. But there's always some element, even in the biggest steaming pile, there's some element in there that works for somebody.
Oh my God. Knee-jerk reaction. I almost... I get 10.
Thank you,
Haley. And they might find a way in the future to take that little kernel within the turd.
There's that corn nugget that didn't digest in the poo-poo.
That made it still steaming.
That you look at it and say, that's a resilient little nugget.
But they find a way to develop that kernel of an idea that worked in something that didn't work, and then they make something.
Corn business.
Oh my God.
There's money in the banana stand.
No, seriously, there's money in the banana stand.
Clearly, we have had just a bit too much to drink.
I have to say, the moonshine was really delicious.
It was. You know, kudos to Hickory Ledges of Canton, Connecticut for their hickory.
Being not official sponsor of the GPR podcast.
But we are open. We are.
If they would like to sponsor the podcast.
Continuity whores, if you will.
All right, well, this has been episode 161 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, I am Jay saying I am so, so sorry that you had to sit through this.
And I'm Kier saying you have seen less of my crotch than John Barrowman.
And I am Haley saying swamp ass.
We totally taught Noel Clark what swamp ass was tonight.
We did.
Five different ones.
He had no clue.
And then he used it in the match game.
He used it.
He did. He used it in the match game.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Gallifrey Public Radio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.
Do it now.
We're good.
Yeah, but we're the last thing of the night, so we can go on as long as we want.
Everybody get comfy.
That's not entirely true.
We're getting heckled already.
Damn. I know.
Gonna go the Josh Friedman route here and say that this is that is true. That is true. All right, we'll get cracking on this because we don't really know what our timestamp is. We're just gonna continue to run until essentially either Ken or Billy or somebody pokes in and says, you know, the hotel is closing and you need to stop. But we'll see.
I feel like at some point somebody's gonna come in and be like, we need to sweep. Could you move?
When we're still, well, great. It's better to be a smartass than a dumbass. So,